He will not force all the kids to know my parents at 8.
Thank you, Michael, and good afternoon. It is an honor for me to be here today. I wish to thank Dr. Shuttleworth for the invitation and Michael, of course, for all the help and assistance that he's given me. Many believe that opera goers and opera audiences are staid, well-behaved, and very respectful. And I'm reminded of a performance of La Gioconda. Placido Domingo was singing, but had to cancel after the first act. And when the stage manager went out to make the announcement that Placido was being replaced by Carlo Bini, the audience started booing. Halfway, and every time Carlo tried to sing, the audience booed. Halfway through that act, Giuseppe Patinè, the conductor, put his baton down, turned around and lectured the audience about their behavior. All of the daily papers carried the story, but I was particularly amused by a story in Sports Illustrated. When audience members tried to quiet the boo birds, fistfights broke out and some patrons slapped one another with programs, resulting in ejection of a number of them by security guards. Conductor Patinè had to be carried from the podium at the end of the act because his blood pressure was acting up. Meanwhile, at Madison Square Garden, the New York Rangers beat the Philadelphia Flyers 5-2. There were no fights in the game, and to round out a perfect evening, most hockey fans managed to get home without running into that rowdy opera crowd. As the poet Yeats said, I wonder anybody does anything at Oxford but dream and remember. This place is so beautiful. One almost expects the people to sing instead of speaking. It is all like an opera. It's obvious that Yeats did not attend that performance of La Gioconda. Opera is messy because life is messy. Opera is many things to many people. I believe that opera elicits strong responses because it's complex and culturally specific. Like any art form, in order to love or respect opera, one has to understand it. And to understand it, one must be exposed to it. It should come as no surprise that as the world changes, so do the arts. As they serve to reflect the human condition, the presentation of performing arts, especially opera, has transitioned from a communal, ephemeral endeavor to one that is now also packaged and commodified. One can hear opera in the theater, cinema, a DVD player, radio, on the internet, and on iPads. Despite these developments and increased revenues, attendance is down. It's safe to say that opera has changed from the mid-20th century to now in different ways. And those changes, those shifts in opera performances, are of great interest to me in what I do. Fundamentally, these shifts in opera are changes in scale. By many accounts, both here and in the United States, opera as an art form is dying. At least that's the impression that one has if it reads the headlines about the dire situation faced by so many opera companies. Indeed, there is cause for concern as well as alarm, for in the US and opera, audiences are becoming smaller and companies are struggling to keep their audiences, let alone build them. Funding for opera companies is reaching a critical moment as government funds are being drastically cut and private funding is significantly affected by the recession in the global economy. Opera is expensive. My predecessor at the Met, Rudolf Bing, said, "The opera always loses money. That's as it should be. Opera has no business making money. Yet opera is a business, a worldwide business that employs thousands and makes money for its communities. I think Mr. Bing was expressing that opera, rather than making, producing, or performing of it, is a kind of noble cause. That is why we need supporters or believers as much as we need audiences. Today, diminishing resources along with the rising costs make the art form positively expensive, creating a Darwinian situation where only the best companies that streamline their operations and create a strong support base will survive. Opera, as we know it, particularly grand opera, may soon be an endangered species. In the 21st century, opera is facing an overwhelming set of challenges, and the question for opera professionals, audiences, and lovers is, whither opera? I am speaking to you today from the perspective of someone who grew up with opera, and therefore I owe it much. To me, opera is one of the highest art forms, not because it is elitist, as many believe it to be, but because it's an amalgam of varied disciplines that have human passion and expression in common. Opera melds music with words and drama, placing it within a visual experience where sound, sight, and movement are brought together for a span of a few hours, precious time, when one is unplugged from the demands of the digital age. I vehemently reject the notion that opera is not relevant to modern life. Most of my career has centered around the art form, principally at the Metropolitan Opera, where I started as an apprentice carpenter at the Old Met on 39th Street, and I rose to the position of general manager and retired from that post in 2006. Since then, I've continued my involvement and interest in the art form from a different perspective, where some distance has allowed me to look at the issues surrounded by the opera and extension the work of performing arts organizations and their livelihoods. Of course, my 40 years of experience in an American company informs these views, but my recent work away from the house has certainly furthered my interest in developments both here and in the U.S. I am not an academic, critic, or even expert in opera. Opera is simply my life. The most significant change in opera from the late 20th century to now is clearly the scale of the course as well as the funding. The conditions of current economic state of affairs has been well discussed and written about. However, a brief mention of a few items puts the severity of crisis into focus. In Italy, La Scala faces a $9 million shortfall because of reductions in subsidies. By the start of 2013, the government of the Netherlands will have cut its arts programs by 25%, or $265 million. At the same time, the government will raise taxes on cultural events from 6 to 19%. But interestingly enough, movie theaters, sporting events, zoos, and circuses are exempted. I think I can make the case that opera is a circus and it should be exempted. In comparison to the aforementioned activities, the taxing of culture seems foolish. Large companies are better equipped than small ones to weather these cuts, as they can claim larger audience, larger attendance, and therefore justify their expenses and lobby for funds. In Portugal, the Ministry of Culture has been abolished. Government subsidies are cut 17% in Italy and 22% in Greece. Smaller American companies such as Baltimore Opera, Connecticut Opera, Opera Pacific, and Opera Boston have shut down. Soon, San Antonio Opera will be joining the list. All of these organizations had a series of problems before the recession, but the 2008 downturn was the death knell. In contrast to Europe, where the arts are part of a cultural legacy and something to be supported, nurtured, and therefore subsidized, in the U.S., the arts, like everything else, is subject to market forces. It is considered more entertainment than enrichment. Government funding is minimal and will continue to be reduced, pressuring companies to rely on patrons and ticket sales. Europeans view art as life, and culture is seen as a need and a right. It's something they deserve. The arts are not just the aspect of culture, but it's part of each European's identity. That said, the reception of works was not of great importance, since ticket sales was not a primary source of revenue. Underscoring the difference between opera in US and Europe, in this comment from Peter de Caldeway from last year's Opera Europa conference, and I quote, "We are subsidized. We are not in the entertainment business. We are there to build community and tell a story. We do too much to please the public. Entertainment is not enough. It's not what the subsidy is for." On the other hand, Australia's Lyndon Terracini says opera should be about entertainment. So there is little consensus of what opera should be or what it is. In Europe, there generally has been a tradition, there has not been a tradition of soliciting private funding from corporations or individuals. Nor has there been a tradition in some European houses of making sure the audience has easy access to tickets and subscription services. Companies in Europe are looking at the American model out of necessity, not choice. Joseph Melillo, executive producer of the Brooklyn Academy of Music, where productions tour, says there's no tradition of individual philanthropy in many of these cultures, so they lack both the motivation and the tax incentives to give. In 2010, Tony Hall of the Royal Opera proposed the government allow income tax reductions or deductions for contributions to solve the cash crisis facing arts organizations in the UK. Americans have long envied having state subsidies and the freedoms that it allows in terms of programming. Fundraising, marketing, and develop all are necessary for funding in the US takes resources away from production. Under the European model, companies can present non-standard works and attempt to enrich and increase its audiences. I often speak of audience in the plural because it can be argued there's not a singular unified audience, but various audiences that reflect the broad range of the operatic repertoire. I use them interchangeably. There are Italian opera lovers, Wagnerites, and those that like Baroque. And think of audiences in plural reflects the fact there are different constituencies within a community that must be programmed for and marketed to. The American model for the arts, one that influenced repertoire, has been criticized for limitations it creates in programming and therefore expression. I've often heard that American companies and their audiences are too conservative. I certainly agree, but understand why. Without arts education and subsidized low-cost ticket prices, increasing access to opera, American companies have to answer its audiences and patrons in the ways that European counterparts do not have to, until now. Despite these cuts in public funding, European companies are still heavily subsidized in comparison to American organizations. Like in the US, European companies have to consider their audience and cultural relevance in ways they never did before. In the US, opera operates more within a sphere of entertainment. It is subject to market forces in a way that some European companies do not have to. Smaller companies in Europe struggling to compete now against larger institutions are funding and having to produce results in terms of attendance and reach. There is a complete shift of consideration for European companies facing budget cuts. Mark Skorka of Opera America has discussed the development in terms of history of European opera companies and the relationship to their audience. By not having to depend on earned revenue and ticket sales, companies in Europe until now did not have the imperative to build a relationship to its audience and have the audience invest in their companies. With all of these changes, companies in both the US and Europe are facing increased challenges in creating and presenting works. In a global economy, we are all connected, for better or for worse. In addition to the woes of opera companies, American audiences feel the effects of what's happening in Europe. European tours to the US have been canceled, or if they do come, they choose cheaper venues for presentations. if they do not skip American cities altogether. That means a loss of cultural opportunity for cities such as Minneapolis and San Diego. Now some European arts organizations are looking for donors in the U.S., increasing the competition for American patrons. The effect of these changes in the economics of opera affect the scale of works that are produced. However, diminished resources can, but not always do, decrease creativity. The demise of so many smaller opera companies in America, victims of their own making along with the recession, is unfortunate. New York City opera falls into that category. One only wishes the best for New York City opera and their plans recharged and reconceptualized. One must acknowledge the death of the legacy that was in existence for over 60 years, one that nurtured singers such as Placido Domingo, Beverly Sills, and Sam Raimi, to name just a few. This is not unfortunate, but it's tragic, particularly on the level of losing a major constituent of Lincoln Center and a major opera company in the American cultural landscape. Known as the People's Opera, City Opera presented works that would not be presented at the Met, a different repertoire for a different audience, therefore increasing the offerings for New Yorkers, as well as providing living wages to its artists and crew. More importantly, New York City Opera was the fertile ground for new singers and opera goers who eventually would also perform or attend the Met. Many people lost their livelihoods and the outlet for their talent should not be discounted or forgotten. It is my personal view the Met was only helped by the existence of New York City Opera, and its absence in the presentation of Grand Opera will be missed. When I speak of Grand Opera, I refer to opera performed by full complement of artists intended by the composer, if not literally, but then in spirit. One certainly can skimp in terms of how many choristers, for example, but after a certain point, it is not Grand Opera, and truthfully, the standard operatic repertoire is best served in its full glory. Any given opera presented in this manner can cost up to 4 or 5 times as much as a symphonic concert, and companies must employ musicians, choristers, production, makeup, wardrobe, and dancers, and countless others. While most of the economic forces discussed thus far focus on grand opera and the major companies in the US and Europe, the smaller companies, those that Opera America would consider level 2 or 3, categorized by the budget size, operate at a different level and economic scale. While smaller companies may have budgetary limitations, they are more nimble at being able to give more creative and present more innovative works. This feature, given the current climate, has made the argument that the art form is flourishing, but not at the level of grand opera. Small companies do not have to plan 5 years ahead to secure the best singers, as in the case of major companies. Smaller companies are lighter on their feet, and they are an important part of opera's future. Besides the larger economic issues facing opera companies, there are inherent internal economic challenges that companies in the US and abroad, albeit with some differences. Since the late 20th century, the cost of producing or presenting opera has gone up, but then again, everything has gone up, such as salaries, medical, and pension expenses. In Europe, many employees are government workers, so the burdens in pension and medical costs are handled differently and do not need to be negotiated every few years. The numbers surrounding healthcare and pension costs in American companies is staggering, and perhaps the number one issue for the future. For not-for-profits, including opera companies, these issues are just as prevalent. Medical costs have gone up an average of 10% a year, and revenue has not kept pace. Having been in a union and then on the other side in management, I can say that unions are often blamed for the sharp rise in labor costs and the cost of producing opera. But the picture is more complicated than that. While it is true the challenges that opera companies face or worsened by union demands. It's simple economics. They are hardly the only obstacle. The reason we have unions in American opera houses is to protect the performers from the history of past where producers did not pay the performers if earned revenues did not cover the expenses. John DeZikes, in his historical account, Opera in America, writes, "Opera was based on cheap labor. Opera companies have been run on the backs of its musicians, choristers, stagehands, and technicians. Those surpluses that Gaddi Cazaza was so proud of was made possible by sweatshop labor behind the curtain and in the pit. Union helps protect employees from being abused in the United States. Unions provide experienced workers with a highly developed skill set, improving the product and operations while simultaneously providing them a living wage." Recently, in program notes for San Francisco Opera, director David Gockley has written about the rising cost for producing opera, given it takes the same number of man hours to perform Don Giovanni now as it did 200 years ago. What David Gockley and others have cited is what's called Baumol's curse. It's also called Baumol's cost disease, named after William Baumol, the economist, who wrote about it in the 60s. Baumol's curse refers to the rise of salaries in labor-intensive fields such as performing arts, healthcare, and guess what? Education. Those areas where you cannot achieve any labor efficiencies or productivity gains, and yet salaries have gone up, even if adjusted for inflation. In opera, wages are not tied to productivity gains. You cannot play a Mozart quartet with three players. The only way to pay higher wages is to increase revenue, meaning higher ticket prices, increased contribution, and government support. Early on in the 20th century, there were musicians and singers available that were starving. What has changed is that society and the rise of unions have moved them from barely subsisting from their craft to becoming part of the middle class. Is this a crime? No. Did they deserve the upward mobility? Ideally, I think so. Why should a musician who attends college and post-secondary school earn less than other professionals with equivalent training and education? Well, there is an answer, and the answer is the art form cannot support it. You give raises where there are efficiencies, but there are none in opera, and yet unions demand them at every negotiation. There is a definite food chain of unions within an American opera house, and this is another issue. The decline of subscriptions, an economic issue for American companies, shows a change in audience behavior. Companies have less advanced cash on hand now than they had in the past. While economic issues can be blamed for the reduction of subscription sales, they should be viewed as audience behavior and how they consume opera. The significant changes in the economies of both Europe and the US influence how audiences behave. But these changes in behavior have been evolving for many years. Who are the audiences for opera in the US? According to a 2008 survey of public participation in the arts, 85% of the U.S. attendees of opera performances in the last 12 months prior to the study were white. Opera audiences are generally white, older, and educated. A 2008 study by the National Endowment of the Arts yielded more information about arts attendance. About 9% of adults attended classical music, and only 2% of the population attended opera. Of those 2%, the group was predominantly comprised of high-income earners. Attendance rises with education level, but interestingly, from 2002 to 2008, there was a drop in participation in the arts by college-educated adults and by its largest group, 45 to 54 years old. Changing demographics are not reflected equally in the change in the diversity of opera audiences. There's no denying the lack of multicultural representation in opera. Opera is not keeping up with successful outreach to new diverse populations that are growing in urban areas. As the general population becomes more and more diverse in the U.S., the operatic repertoire, for the most part, fails to reflect their cultures and music. At least it's so in grand opera. We must attempt not to impose our Western European cultural values on, yet the operatic repertoire generally does that. As mentioned before, the educated audiences are consumers of opera, and there is less and less emphasis on cultural values in education, whether it is the obliteration of arts in the schools or the demise of liberal arts college education. Opera companies are faced with a public that have less exposure and knowledge for what they have to offer. The topic of graying audiences is often discussed in the U.S. as ticket revenue and private donations are a primary source of funding. Graying audience, if one accepts the term, also means graying donors, creating a situation where a limited number of donors can leave a company in precarious situations should one of the major donors die. San Francisco Opera has been open in discussing its organization's vulnerability due to the fact that most of the company's private donors come from 11 families whose heads are over the age of 70. Reading the obits every morning takes on another significance. San Francisco's problem is acute representation of what many American companies face. The age factor, the graying of American opera audiences, is also key in understanding the programming in the U.S. that is responsive to its audience and donor base, especially where more than half the operating revenues come from those private donors. Older audiences are not keen on innovative stage interpretations of the classic or new works. Instead, they prefer what they already are familiar with, the grand and the classic. The experimental or non-standard piece has to be well chosen from an artistic as well as financial perspective, unless there's a specific donor willing to foot the bill. The conservatism is nudged even further by either the desire to appease and attract donors. Through time, this does affect the art form, making it more narrow and less rich. Audiences are buying fewer subscription sales today than they have in the past, which means that the American companies have lost a significant base of financial support. Opera audiences are not committing their money in advance, and instead they're buying single tickets. And the reason is they know the box office is not selling out. In the old house, the Met, prior to 1966, the subscription base was 90% of capacity, meaning there were only 10% of the tickets available for single sale. And I can recall Mr. Bing would get on the radio and announce the non-subscription performance dates for the next season so that the public could go buy tickets. And I recall him saying, and I quote, "Now, you poor dears, I will tell you the performances that are available so you can rush out and buy your tickets." I keep hearing from my colleagues in Chicago and elsewhere that subscriptions are way down. During my time at the Met, I attempted to address the situation by creating subscriptions of trios and quartets, as people were not buying subscriptions for up to 7 operas. And that is for the Met, which has a long season and numerous operas, but it was only moderately successful. There have been times when companies themselves have been to blame for the decrease in subscription sales. The 26-week 1969 labor dispute at the Met is an example where the Met did not handle its audience well, and its subscriptions dropped from 90% to 70%. In 1980, there was an 11-week labor dispute, and after that, the prescription base dropped to 50%. Presently, the percentage of subscription sales is even less than 35%, indicating how much the ticket buying behavior has changed. season interruptions affect subscriber habits. New York City's opera's Dark Season is a recent example of this. Without a season, the company lost most of its audience, and although the change in programming and performing venue were also factors, but they lost their ticket buyers and their donors. Programming must balance discovery, rediscovery, along with presenting the traditional repertoire so that people are encouraged to purchase single tickets and subscriptions. Even adjusting exchange policies can only help so much. American opera companies are increasingly looking for ways to help entice the ticket buyer to come to the opera. During the 80s and 90s, the most expensive seats were always sold first. Now it's the less expensive ones. The 2008 National Endowment Survey noted consumer spending on performing arts admissions tracks closely with the trends in the U.S. economy. One of the impediments of going to the opera is high ticket prices. If one reduces ticket prices, more people will go to the opera. It is proven. With Opera Pacific, a now defunct company, when they had a donor who subsidized tickets, attendance was at an all-time high. New York City Opera, an almost defunct opera company, sold out their performances at Brooklyn Academy when a donor stepped up to subsidize ticket prices so all tickets were $25. Lowering ticket prices also fights claims of elitism due to the exclusion and provides an incentive to try unfamiliar work. In the United States, opera audiences are declining. They go to the opera for entertainment. Preference for entertainment has also changed. People want to be entertained as before, but they are not more likely to attend attend casual activities. Competition for entertainment time and dollars has now become fierce. In the past, going to the opera was seen as something that was glamorous, a social activity. You dressed up and you went. It was more of an event. I have heard to go to the opera, you have to dress up in a tuxedo and pay lots of money. Today, one doesn't have to dress up, which is good, and it makes it easier for people to attend, but it's not so good because it makes the event less special. It's like having a double-edged sword. Having people dress up reinforces the notion that going to opera, symphony, or ballet is a special event that enhances the experience of all the participants. It's not an elitist requirement anymore, but it is nice. The persistent notion that opera is elitist does not square with the reality of today. With low-cost ticket programs and free performances, access can no longer be said to be exclusive and out of reach. Rudolph Bing said once, "I don't insist on white tie, I don't insist on black tie, but I do insist on a tie." Contrast this with blue jeans and flip-flops of today. With today's shortened attention spans, a four-hour opera is a hard sell for commitment-phobic adults in the digital age. Diversions like the internet with video and music streaming along with texting keep people from going out to spend money on other forms of entertainment such as theaters or live performances. Those that consume art online are growing, and the 2008 survey noted that 4 in 10 U.S. adults who use the internet did so to view, listen, and download or post artworks or performances that year. It's hard to get people to disconnect from their smartphones prior to the baton coming down. At the Met, if you sit way up in the family circle and look down at the orchestra section right below, before the overture begins, after the famous chandeliers go up, you can see people are resisting to turning off their BlackBerries and smartphones. The glow of a screen mid-aria is jarring and destroys the atmosphere. The ability to disconnect should be an opportunity, not a hindrance. The desire for casual dress and formality is prevalent in theaters in the U.S. Recently, I went to a Broadway show. The woman in front of me was eating potato chips. Behind me was a man and his cell phone went off, and he's talking on the phone. This occurs so often that now people talk about how it should be expected and that these things happen, indicating there is more tolerance today for these indiscretions. In my current work at Theater Project Consultants, clients want cup holders put in arms in opera houses. So can you imagine what we're facing? You're going to have someone opening their wax paper sandwich. They have their crisps, and then they put the Diet Coke in the cup holder. New media. Audiences have changed over the years. More people consume opera through media than in the theater. In 2008, 5% or 11 million adults viewed or listened to opera via broadcast and recorded media. Currently, the opera is no longer an ephemeral one-time event. Audiences have changed because there are so many forms of opera presentation today. New media basic deals with engagement and new ways of engaging audiences, which is a priority as opera companies face drops in attendance and competition from other forms of entertainment. All forms of new media extend the life of a performance. Through social media, such as Facebook and Twitter, audiences have changed because they're relating to each other and the world in the world in different ways. The informal exchange of thoughts and ideas that once happens in person now happens online. Opera companies have to join the conversation to maintain cultural relevance and to attract younger audiences. Social media has become an integral part of an opera company's marketing and education strategy and is essential for the performing arts to compete with other forms of entertainment. This is a new era for engagement between opera companies and their established and prospective audience members. Having and maintaining a strong online presence is an imperative for any opera company for information, marketing, and of course, ticket sales. The company's website and social networking sites must all be maintained and updated regularly. Facebook and Twitter can create informal dialogue between followers and companies so that the opera companies can effectively communicate with the local and otherwise would not have the with their local communities and international communities. The Met's Live in HD series was pioneered by my successor at the Met, Peter Gelb, and launched in the 2006-07 season into movie theaters around the world. It recently celebrated a sales record of 10 million tickets in venues found in 54 countries. Last year, it made $11 million in net profits. In addition to the function of a source of income and audience development, the Met has used the series as its educational outreach. It started modestly in 2007-08 with 5 New York City schools and is currently transmitting to 25 markets in 19 states. There are also other venues that offer opera content. One known as Opera and Cinema has distributed live and tape performances from La Scala, Covent Garden, and other opera houses. Opera is not the only art form breaking into movie theaters. Ballet, symphonies, and theater companies are following and trying to enter the market. On a smaller scale or smaller screen, what was once known as Met Player on the Met website is now called Met On Demand. In conjunction with the development of an iPad app that offers access to the Met catalog of 350 performances. It is a subscription service like satellite radio transmissions, and the idea of radio broadcasts are brought then to a different level. You can have opera on the radio 24 hours a day. Mostly, companies in Europe are able to stream performances online, but they have not monetized those offerings to the extent the Met has. All of the above serve to expand the consumption of opera, but are often at the cost to the opera goer, and therefore its reach to underrepresented audiences is limited to those that can afford and already have an interest in opera. Simulcasts are a marriage between old-fashioned free concerts with cinema with a dose of sports. Many simulcasts occur in public places and spaces, but the advent of the free simulcast in public sports arenas has taken off for many companies. The hope is that free simulcasts will generate new interest, visibility, and attract new audiences. They also create a community event, a special and risk-free entry-level activity that is economical for the company and audience. San Francisco Opera has presented simulcasts since 2006. The company has been able to track an increase of 48,000 new audience members to the audience in the theater, which was one of its primary goals. Free simulcasts have also extended the marketing reach and visibility within the community of San Francisco. Other cities are following suit. Dallas Opera plans to break attendance records for their simulcast of Magic Flute on April 28th, and Seattle Opera will present Madame Butterfly on May 5th. All new media has changed the kind of engagement and the relationship an opera company has with its audience. Audiences have changed their behavior because of many reasons, including how they consume opera as well as how they relate to it. New media has obviously changed how opera is presented, but has it or will it change the art form? After considering all the recent and current developments in opera, the economic and audience issues, along with new media, the obvious question to me is whether or not the art form is any different and will it change? Is it changing? I think Noel Cowell's quip, "People are wrong when they say opera is not what it used to be." It is what it used to be. That's what's wrong with it. In light of everything I have mentioned thus far, I am quite ambivalent about the question, unusual for me, as I'm known for having strong opinions. I think that opera itself, the art form, has changed in certain ways, but not so in others. For U.S. companies, economic pressures influence programming to a degree that I feel our European counterparts cannot claim. Seasons everywhere have been reduced, so the companies are presenting fewer works, and there are safer ones, and I refer to larger companies. That means that certain operas are presented more often than others. This has a cumulative effect of narrowing the offerings for the public as well as the artists. For example, the most frequently performed operas in the 2010-11 season in the U.S. were Bohème, Figaro, Butterfly, Magic Flute, Daughter of the Regiment, Tosca, Traviata, Turandot, Carmen, and Lucia di Lammermoor. Generally speaking, if performing the same war horses, audiences suffer, but does the art form? Doesn't opera become more narrow if predominantly the same work gets produced all the time? Is the operatic canon and therefore the art form diminished by programming that is not subsidized and competes in an entertainment market, which is the U.S. model? I think so. Perhaps this is uniquely an American view. I also try to consider the dearth of American singers of a certain stature and the ability and wonder or not, are singers changing because what's being performed is not. While the larger opera companies in the U.S. have been playing it safe in terms of programming and risk, in the 21st century, smaller opera companies have been where the art form is still creative and not staid. Mark Skorker of Opera America comments that opera has never been better, more creative, inventive, with new composers that at this time because of small companies. He feels that the efforts from smaller companies funnel through to large companies, such as the Met, the Lyric, LA, and San Francisco. Small companies prove that reduced resources are not an obstacle to innovation, and they invigorate the art form. In addition, efforts from big companies such as LA and the Royal Opera attempt to do what smaller companies are doing well, providing opera in alternative venues. It's a great way to re-energize their company and brand. Because of their small size, companies do things differently compared to grand opera, and they attempt more experimental stagings of classics, unusual or new works, using young and upcoming singers. There's no point in competing with large companies, and they don't. Instead, they increase the variety and broaden the number of works presented. Opera is consumed more through media than the live performance in the theater, and this means the experience for the consumer is different. The experience of being in the theater with other people witnessing a performance in person is the height of operatic experience. I agree with Bruce Beresford, who states, when the music and the characters are flawlessly synchronized, the opera develops an emotional force that movies and plays cannot match. At its best, there is nothing like a live performance, and yet so many opera lovers are appreciating aspects of operas in movie theaters or during a simulcast because they can see close-ups of the singers and feel the immediacy of the individual performance. New media audiences, however, only see part of the picture, literally and figuratively. They do not see the whole picture and are also deprived of the atmosphere on stage and in the house. I've asked some singers if they think the advent, or rather the proliferation of new media affects performances, and I've gotten a range of responses dependent on the function of the individual. One would think that it is clear that knowing cameras can see your every gesture, if you're on stage as a performer, this will inform, if not dictate, how you move, how you gesture, of course, how you sing, even just slightly, unconsciously. I asked Joyce DiDonato, what, if anything, does she do differently for a live broadcast? And she mentioned something about, I need to lose weight, which to note, she doesn't. Radio broadcasts have been around, but now the attention to aesthetic values and detail take hold in makeup, wig, and wardrobe and lighting. Even with all these changes in the staging and production, I do not think the art form is changing in essence. It is still the same formula and the same players. The music and voices come first. Supposedly, in the movie theater, everyone gets the same view. In theory, the experience of opera is completely different. Missing from movie theaters is the atmosphere of live performance, of being right there. What the movie audience does get in terms of immediacy is the close-up and the backstage scenes, which is exchanged for the immediacy of seeing it all. The full picture of the stage happened before you. Does this diminish the experience of opera or enhance it? I think the multiple ways that opera is disseminated are all good, but not equal. Gerard Mortier's stance on the topic comes to mind and is impassioned and a valid one. Also, I question whether presentations of opera through new media takes away the urgency to attend the live event. As of now, there are no sure answers, but I think it's only responsible to ask. I do agree that visual aspects of opera are more and more important because new media, but then again, DVD recordings and live television radio broadcasts face the same challenges, but not in high definition. Unfortunately, opera doesn't change enough in terms of composition of its audience. Until newer studies are done, the impact of new media, social media, and the development of new forms of disseminating opera, the jury is out, but the effort to reach them cannot be denied. Opera is music and voice first, but it is the production of opera that can be key for audiences. Before, one would go to opera to hear it, and now people say, I go to see it. The visual aspect of opera has become very important for audiences. They want to look at something that is interesting or effective. At the Met, productions and the staging have changed from the beginning of the 20th century to now. Though the topic alone could be a long discussion, I would quickly like to show you a few slide images to demonstrate the point. And I wish to thank Bob Tuggle, who's the archivist at the Met, for helping me put these slides together. This was Faust, the garden scene, in 1908. And this is the same scene in 2005. So you can see the differences. One was a flatter production, and there has been some change, but not a great deal. In 2011, this is the garden scene of the new production at the Met. So you can see that it's, and this is a production that was a co-production with the English National Opera. When we talk of Baumel's curse and efficiencies in opera, you can see this production of Aida was the early 1900s. The triumphal scene 20 years later looked like that. Then we had the Ralph Gerard production that opened in 1951, which was much more built scenery. The 1963 production, which was Robert O'Hearn, the designer, and the present production of the Met, which is all built scenery. So the expenses, of course, have gone up substantially. Now, I find this interesting because this is Lohengrin set in 1950. This is Wolfgang Wagner, who died prior to this opening, but this was the world-famous director who made so many changes in Bayreuth, and this was a very static production of Lohengrin. And here is the Robert Wilson production of Lohengrin, and you'll see that it really, I mean, has changed somewhat, but not a great deal. Now, I do want to quote a very famous composer who said, "One can't judge Wagner's opera Lohengrin after a first hearing, and I certainly don't intend to hear it a second time." That was Rossini. Now, this was Bohème circa 1930 with some very famous singers, Beniamino Gigli, Ezio Pinza. And this is the Met's current production, Franco Zeffirelli, which opened in 1980. We then have a very early Traviata, which was performed in the Met's first season. And then a design from 1935. And Franco's production of Act One. And this is the new Met production, which is based on the clock ticking off. That's when the clock gets to a certain point, she then, of course, dies. This is an early Rheingold, which probably have some of my early relatives in it. However, they didn't trim their beards. Rhine Maidens flying, and that's a production of 1918. And then Valhalla, the entrance of the gods into Valhalla in 1948. This is the famous Otto Schenk production of Rheingold with the Rainbow Bridge to Valhalla. This is the current production of The Ring, and this is Rheingold. But I just want to point out, it looks like a NASA space station with all of the computer screens. It's a highly technical production, very costly. And here the gods are walking to Valhalla up these planks. Now, of course, these productions, if you look at them, compared to what you see today in Europe, could be considered quite boring. So I thought I might show you just a couple of photos, and maybe, given the photo, you could guess what they are. I had some difficulty with it, but maybe you could do it. I discover that's Anna Bolena. And this is Masked Ball. Anybody venture a guess? Well, it's Don Giovanni, of course. Can't you see that? So I'm saving this. Bill Conner is here for the interview when we talk about innovation. Now, we do have some other innovative operas, which I know you'll guess this one. This is Pique Dame, Queen of Spades. It looks like the Easter Bunny to me, but I couldn't quite figure it out. And then, here's an opera that, of course, was just played in Germany, and that's The Bronze Horse. Now, I don't want to keep that slide up, heaven forbid. So let me go back to something at least. Let me go back to this. I believe that the very survival of this art form, which is expensive to produce, depends on responsible management and board leadership for all companies. There are many times when extremely successful and intelligent businessmen attend a not-for-profit board meeting and check their brains with their hats and coats. What is needed is a process for education of the not-for-profit board members in the United States, which would generate the kind of leadership needed for performing arts. The stakes are high. It is no hobby. I would like to address the idea of sustainability, a term which Americans usually refer to environmental concerns. In a recent Opera Europa conference, the term was applied to opera as a way of discussing opera's self-sustaining ability to keep itself alive. And I must admit, to compare opera, the most synthetic of arts, to the natural resources of the earth is a stretch even for me. That said, I can understand why Europeans would enjoy hearing the musings that have little connection to the complexities they face. I suppose Europeans have had the luxury of subsidies that do not appear, or I should say that do appear, like natural resources. To suggest that the failure of underperforming companies is healthy for an industry is callous, and it shows the application concepts and ideas at random only serves to distract companies from what they must do. I think the future in opera, opera companies doing co-productions of non-standard works is important. It allows you to produce new works, works that have not been performed because companies cannot afford to mount them alone. This increases the repertoire for companies involved so that companies can attract a more varied audience. In the U.S., opera companies must find a way of increasing their audience base by producing operas that will attract the minority populations which are growing in the urban areas. New media, especially HD series, is the first time that progress has been made in terms of Bommel's curse, finding new revenue without substantial increases in expense. Despite the arguments against opera and cinemas, I can give you $11 million reasons why it's a valid effort on the part of a major opera company. The question for opera companies is how much of their resources can be spent on new media given the cost and opportunities for distribution. Social media costs very little and yet can be quite effective. Mark Skorka had some interesting insight to offer to attract more people to the theater, and that was to attention of the experience of attending the opera, making sure that as pleasurable as possible. This is simple and intuitive. European companies, I believe, have a different set of issues. Principally, they must learn some lessons from their American counterparts to cultivate corporate and private funding, investment as opposed to subsidy, and how to change the relationship they have with their audiences. They have to assess their programming to demonstrate they will continue to fulfill their education or enrichment for which they receive those subsidies. I think it's dangerous to view the crisis that is affecting the arts as something separate out there. So ownership of the crisis is important to motivate companies to tackle issues and not be complacent. All opera companies must make the case to their governments and businesses that arts organizations have significant economic impact and should be supported because they draw visitors that spend money and draw other businesses. In addition, the arts sector in the U.S. provides jobs employing 3.4 million people. Opera companies are not museums. I loathe the comments that make this comparison. It's not enough to present less familiar works unless efforts are made to support that work with marketing and education. Playing to as many people as possible fights claims of elitism. Opera will, like everything else, learn to adapt or die out, but I think there's enough creative vitality for the art form to survive given the industry's ability to take the lead. Smaller opera companies, those that can attract new composers, artists, and audiences, are the sector that will elicit general buzz. In the face of dire economic challenges in the U.S. and abroad, I am more optimistic than I should be because theaters are being built around the world. At the worst time in its recent history, Greece is actually building a new opera house. It's not nuts, it's ambitious and hopeful, exactly what we need all the time. I think it's important for opera practitioners, such as myself, to look at issues facing opera with a more objective view and a less nostalgic one. I cannot help quoting Rudolph Bing when he took over the Met in 1950. He made an interesting statement. The Metropolitan Opera, like any other working organization, must adapt its methods to the prevailing conditions of the day. What may have been right now might have been quite wrong before, and what was right so far may be wrong in the future. Opera is changing because the world is, and one hopes it's able to adapt. At the very essence, it stays basically the same with the same components and its resilience due to its complexity and richness. Opera may sound different and look different than it did 50 years ago or 100 years ago, but its DNA is the same. It's a collaborative effort of different disciplines joining together. I'd like to close with a quote. And the quote is, as an opera begins long before the curtain goes up and ends long after it comes down. It starts in my imagination. It becomes my life. And it stays part of my life long after I left the opera house. Maria Callas. Thank you. Thank you. That's enough.